traditional Lutheran attitude toward Erasmus, and that is that he was a coward. He really agreed with Luther. He wasn't courageous enough to come out and say so. He was of no mind to be a martyr. But what Erasmus actually said was, I hope I would be willing to be a martyr for Christ, but I don't intend to be a martyr for the paradoxes of Luther. He insisted that Luther was not a heretic, but he said nevertheless there were some points on which he did not agree with him. Is this really necessary, or can you hear me without it? It is necessary. All right, well, let's put up with it. Yeah, I hate these mechanics. I wish I were like Whitney who could speak to 20,000 people out of doors and be heard. Now then, I'm not going to be bothered with staying near it, I can tell you that.
Can't you get it out of the road?
All right. Fair enough. The traditional picture is that Luther was, Erasmus was a coward. He was afraid of martyrdom. Well, he died in bed. Luther did too. The reason why Luther died in bed was that the emperor was too tied up fighting the Pope and the French and the Turks to come and get him. And when the emperor finally got around to it, Luther had just died. And the reason why Erasmus died in bed was that he died soon enough. He died in 1536. By the 1560s, the disciples of Erasmus were being put to death. The line taken by Erasmus was that he agreed with Luther in part, but not wholly. That he agreed with the Catholic Church in part, but not wholly. And that he wished to mediate between them, and that he would not leave the Catholic Church because he still hoped for a reformation from within. Luther had come to despair of any reformation from within. The position of Erasmus was, in my judgment, perfectly honorable and perfectly consistent and genuinely courageous, because it meant that he was rejected by the Catholics on the ground that he was really a Lutheran, and rejected by the Lutherans on the ground that he hadn't got enough courage to be a Lutheran. He took the middle of the road and invited repudiation by both sides. Well, there's something to be said for the middle of the road liberal, if I may say so, who gets battered in both directions, both by the right and by the left. Now, of course, Luther got battered from the left too, as his life went on. And he said the attack from the left hurt him more than the attack from the Catholics. He was referring to Münster and Karlstadt and Zwilling and the Zwickau prophets and so on. He too was in the middle, as a matter of fact. As far as that's concerned, I think practically every reformer is in the middle, except an absolute extremist, who's usually only one person. But nearly everyone who starts a reform will have it followed by something which is still more to the left, and he finds himself in the middle. Well, with this word of preface, let me say that Erasmus represents one aspect of reform in the 16th century. As a matter of fact, it was not one reformation. I would suggest there were at least four reformations, two of them Catholic and two of them Protestant. And on the Catholic side, you have the liberal, tolerant, non-dogmatic, ethical, evangelical, that is back to the gospel, type of reform, of which Erasmus was the chief exponent. There were others in all countries of Europe. It was a very widespread movement in the early years of the 16th century. It was a period of comparative latitude. The medieval sects had been suppressed, the church felt secure, and it allowed a good deal of free discussion. But when the Lutheran movement arose, the lines began to be tightened. Catholicism moved into the direction of discipline, dogmatism, authority, intolerance, and the outcome was what is called the Counter-Reformation, which found its expression in the Council of Trent. And this movement suppressed the earlier movement, and a great many of the liberals of the early period of the century were either sent to the stake or spent their last years in the chambers of the Inquisition. It was even true of Cardinal Carranza, the primate of Spain. For ideas no more liberal than those of Erasmus, he spent the last 17 years of his life in the chambers of the Inquisition. Cardinal Moroni was imprisoned during the entire pontificate of Paul IV, who was one of the intransigent popes. Now, on the Protestant side, we have the main line of Luther, Zwingli, Calvin, Cranmer, the outstanding reformers. But then we have to the left of them, and on the sacraments, Zwingli is to the left, but not on the church-state relationship. To the left of them, we have the Anabaptists, who call for a voluntary church, an adult conversion experience as a condition for church membership, the separation of church and state, and religious liberty. These are all axioms in the American pattern at the present time. The Anabaptists were put to death for advocating these principles in the 16th century. And then there were others who formed no organization, rationalists, who called into question the traditional doctrine of the Trinity, spiritualists, who said even the Bible is not so important as the Spirit, and if you're in the Spirit, in which the writers of the Bible were, you won't need the Bible, because you'll be like them. So away with the Bible, said Thomas Spencer. Beeble, bobble, boo-boo, he said. And Luther replied, if you don't adhere to the word of Scripture, I don't care if you swallowed the Holy Ghost, feathers and all. The Holy Ghost, of course, was symbolized as a dove. So here was a whole left-wing party to the left of Luther. Now, the curious thing about it is that in some respects, it seems to me, the line runs from Erasmus, the liberal Catholic reformer, to the more radical Protestant reform, because Zwingli found his prophet in Erasmus rather than in Luther. Now, an interesting thing about it, and it'll come out as we go along, was that Erasmus so spiritualized religion that he thought outward aids were not necessary, namely images, pictures, music, and all. He would keep the sacrament, but the bread and the wine, it really doesn't matter insofar as they're physical, no matter what they are, it won't do you any good unless you commune with Christ in the Spirit. Well, now, you can take that more radically than he did to the point of saying, if they're not really necessary, why you get rid of them? And Zwingli gave up music and gave up images and said that the Lord's Supper was purely a memorial of Christ's death and a sign that you believe. And the Anabaptists did that, and the Quakers finally gave up the external sacraments altogether. That's the ultimate of this type of spiritualizing of religion. Melanchthon said that if Luther hadn't arisen to arrest the radicalism of Erasmus, the results would have been more subversive. And he had in mind the spiritualizing of all of the external elements of religion. Luther was a good Catholic on this point. He kept the tradition of the Catholic Church with its external aids, with its pictures, with its music, with its external sacrament. And Erasmus, in some respects, was more subversive of the Catholic tradition by this spiritualizing of religion. Well, all of this proves that the Reformation is not a simple phenomenon.
it cut across the whole of Europe, and it developed a number of varieties. Now, Erasmus was very definitely a reformer, and his idea was to reform by going back to the past. Today, the reformers all say, the past, forget it. Start right here. All that matters is the present and the future. The men of that day were in rebellion against the immediate past in terms of a return to a more remote past. In Christianity, it meant going back to the New Testament. They said, we're not starting anything new. Zwingli says, this is 1522 years old. He said, you Catholics have gone off the track. We're going back to the original New Testament. It's going back. Erasmus wanted to go back to the New Testament and the early church fathers and also the classical authors, Plato, Socrates, Cicero, Plutarch, particularly because the New Testament hasn't got much about politics and society. It deals primarily with personal religion, the relationship of the individual to God. It has a few texts about political matters, such as Render Unto Caesar, and an enormous superstructure has been built on these texts. But if you want a philosophy of politics, you go to Plato, the Republic, you go to Aristotle on politics, and so on. Now, Erasmus wanted to reform not only the church, but the whole society. And this he would do by reviving the Christian classical tradition, not Jewish. He didn't particularly like the Old Testament. It has some fine passages. But he did not like the wars of the Lord for the extermination of the Canaanites. He said there are passages in the Old Testament which, unless you allegorize them, are not as edifying as the histories of Livy. Well, he did allegorize the passages in the Old Testament which he felt were not genuinely Christian. But it's not primarily the Judeo-Christian, but the classical Christian tradition which he would revive. Now, he thought of the way to do it was by education. But he didn't intend to be a teacher. He wanted to be a teacher of teachers, providing them with the materials for education, which meant the works of the New Testament, of the early church fathers, of the philosophers and the poets of antiquity. Only a little bit of this was available in print. Printing was only a little over 50 years old. So he dedicated his whole life to collecting manuscripts, translating often the Greek into Latin, but publishing some in Greek and some in Latin. He spent his whole life running around to libraries, hunting up manuscripts, and to publishers and printing presses. He said, if Ulysses was the wisest man in Greece because he had visited so many cities, my horse is the wisest in Europe because he has attended so many universities. Well, you'll find Erasmus in the Low Countries. That's where he was born. You'll find him in Anderlecht and Brussels and Deventer and Saint-Omer. You'll find him in London and Paris, in Oxford and Cambridge, in Orléans and Basel, in Strasbourg, in Venice, in Bologna, in Rome. No man was so traveled in his generation, and he was always in search of such materials. We don't know exactly when he was born. He wasn't sure himself. Some references point to 1466 and some to 1469, and the matter became crucial a few years ago in order to decide when to have the celebration. And the Swiss decided on 66 and had it, and the Dutch on 69, and they waited a few years. Well, he was born, and that's really the important point, and he was the illegitimate son of a priest. He was born in the Low Countries. He's called Erasmus of Rotterdam. The father was not irresponsible. He gave money for the education of Erasmus and his older brother, but he couldn't bring the boys up. The mother had to do that,
And when Erasmus was six, she sent him away to school at Deventer, or Deventer, I think they call it in Dutch. This was a great educational center in the Low Countries. It was also the center of the Brethren of the Common Life. Now, this was a new kind of monastic order. At first, they took no vows. They lived in community for as long as they wanted to stay there. They devoted themselves to devotional exercises, manual labor, and teaching. And they often planted their members in schools all over Germany and some in France. There were some in Paris. They got as far south as Basel in Switzerland. I just saw the church, which was the most southerly point that they reached. These brethren, after a while, divided. And one group had lifelong vows. They did it under pressure from the other orders. And one group remained without the vows. Their best known representative is Thomas A. Kempis. And he wrote The Imitation of Christ. There are, I think, three important notes in that work. One is a lyrical piety toward Jesus. There are passages of genuine poetry in which he breaks out in praise of the Lord Jesus and the imitation of Christ, particularly in the way of suffering. But another point is an aversion to overly refined theological speculation. The Trinity, he said, is better pleased by adoration than by speculation. And another member of the group inquired about the theology of the penitent thief. How much theology did he have? He'd never been baptized. He'd never had the Eucharist. He'd never heard about transubstantiation. He didn't know anything about homoousios. All the theology he had was the belief that Christ could get into paradise. How little theology it takes to be saved. This is penitent thief theology, if you please. It's minimal. Now, these notes run through Erasmus. A lyrical piety toward Jesus, the following in his steps, and an aversion to overly refined theological speculation. He was no theologian in the technical sense, though he was well acquainted with all of the theologies and had something to say about them. When he was 16, the question came up, what next? The money left by his father had run out. The boy already had great gifts and intellectual interests. His guardian thought the best thing to do was to make him a monk. And he wanted him to join the branch of the Brethren with lifelong vows. Erasmus very stoutly resisted. In after years, he regretted that he had not joined the branch without the vows. Well, why didn't he? I think the reason was that he had lived for 2 years in the house of the Brethren without vows. And in that particular house, there was nobody who shared his interests in literature, both classical and Christian. But the branch with the vows had a magnificent library. Luther went into the monastery to save his soul by good works, and Erasmus went into the monastery to improve his mind by good books. He was there for six years. He had no major friction with the Brethren. There was one tilt over the study of classical works, which some of them objected to. They made him a priest. And in after years, whenever he was in the area, he came back to visit the Brethren. But after 6 years, he was resting. His prior saw it, thought that he would be happier as secretary to a bishop, and got him such a position. But the bishop didn't really need him. He was generous and understanding, and provided him with a stipend to enable him to go to the University of Paris as a candidate for the degree of doctor in theology. Well, now, of course, he had to study the scholastic theologians. He said they reminded him of a character in Greek legend who went to sleep for 46 years, except that he did wake up. But as for these scholastic theologians, he had his doubts about their ever waking up. They were discussing questions like this. If God had so desired, could he have become incarnate? Not in the man, Christ Jesus, but in a donkey or a pumpkin? Oh, blah. Your ass would say to a question like that. But it was a serious question. It was a part of a whole series of questions. And they all had to do with God's omnipotence. If God has absolute power, if he can do anything, can he do absolutely anything? Can he make black white? Can he make right wrong? Can he make the past not to have been the past so that a harlot will be a virgin? Can he do something preposterous like becoming incarnate in a donkey or a pumpkin? Erasmus felt that absolute power would corrupt even God. There must be some self-imposed limits upon omnipotence, or God isn't moral. If the Christian morality can be overthrown tomorrow if God decides that way. The religious basis for the Christian ethic is completely undercut. Erasmus said, let God be good. Now that comes up again by and by. After 6 years, he still had not taken his degree as Doctor of Theology, and the bishop began to suspect that he was becoming a professional graduate student. He cut off his stipend, he had to earn some money, and he began tutoring. The best thing that ever happened to him, it caused him to begin to compose those manuals of education, which weren't published until some 20 years later, but eventually became the textbooks in the schools of France, of Germany, of Switzerland, of England, and the American colonies, well down into the 18th century. I wish I had time to describe them, but we'll have to move on. The other advantage that came from tutoring was that he got acquainted with students. Well, now one of them was a young Englishman, Lord Mountjoy, who invited Erasmus to go with him to England. And they crossed the Channel in the summer of 1499. We have the first letter which Erasmus wrote back to a friend in France. He wrote, you would hardly know you're Erasmus. He goes out on the chase. He has become a courtier. And if you knew the sweetness of the kisses of these English nymphs, you would fly like Daedalus over the Channel even if you had the gout. Well, some have wondered whether Erasmus was demeaning himself in a manner appropriate to the life of a young monk and priest. But there are two points to remember. One is that kissing on meeting between the sexes was customary in England, but not on the continent. We know that from independent testimony. And when Philip of Spain came to marry Mary Tudor, he thoroughly shocked his Spanish companions by approaching his bride-to-be and kissing her on the lips. So there was a difference between the French and the English custom. But the other point is that Erasmus had an amazing capacity for adapting himself to the tastes of the people to whom he wrote letters. Often his letters are more revealing of the character of the person to whom he wrote than of himself. Now, the man to whom he wrote this letter, and I bring him in because we'll meet him again, was an Italian, Fausto Androlini, who had become a French citizen, more French than the French, was teaching poetry at the Sorbonne. He'd written quite a few love poems. We've got first editions of them in the Yale Library. He was a gay blade and a man of great charm, and for Erasmus, charm covered a multitude of sins. Erasmus was fond of him, And as I said, we'll meet him again. But Erasmus certainly did not spend long dallying with any English nymphs in the country estate of Lord Mountjoy. Very quickly we find him at Oxford, staying with the Brethren of the Common Life and working there very diligently on his studies. And there he came in contact with a group of very remarkable young men. I'll mention only two. One was John Collett, who later became the Dean of St. Paul's, and the other was Thomas More, who was to become Sir Thomas and St. Thomas. The association with these young men had a great influence on Erasmus. For one thing, it enhanced his self-esteem. Here was a poor boy, the illegitimate son of a priest, treated with respect and deference by men who were the scions of the English aristocracy, men of brilliance, and men of substance. But he was also impressed by their quality. They were men into whose lap fortune had poured her all, and who were ready to throw it all away for what they believed, as later they proved. He also learned from them the certain new directions for his work, where they persuaded him that he must learn Greek. If he were to interpret Plato, Aristotle, Plutarch, the great works of classical antiquity, he couldn't get along with only Latin. Just Cicero wasn't enough. And if he were to interpret the New Testament, and Origen, and Chrysostom, and the early father, he'd have to know Greek. He resolved, therefore, that strenuously he would go to work on Greek. He went back after 5 months to Paris to hunt up a native Greek to work with. Ronnie wasn't much of a teacher, though. And then we find him back in the Low Countries. This term is applied to what? To the country that is now Belgium and Holland. They were united at that time. They were called the Netherlands, that is, the Netherlands, the Lowlands, because they were low, and only the dikes kept out the water. So he's back again in the Netherlands. And then he wrote a little tract, which was to enjoy an enormous popularity, and by the end of the century had gone into about 6 translations. Erasmus never wrote in any language except Latin. It could be understood by educated men all over Europe. But Dutch, his native language, was known only in a small locality. But he never bothered to learn English, though he was in England 5 times, nor Italian, he was there for over a year, nor German, he was in German-speaking territory for some 7 years. Latin was enough. So this tract was written in Latin. He called it the Dagger of the Christian Soldier. In it he inveighs against externalism in religion, the cult of relics, going on pilgrimages, prayers to the saints for material benefits. But one finds in it also another strain. And this also he had imbibed from that group of young Englishmen, because nearly all of them had been in Italy. And Thomas More, though he had not been there, had learned Italian. They had come in contact with the revival of Neoplatonism. Now, Neoplatonism holds that the body and the soul are opposed to each other. The body is a prison of the soul, even a tomb of the soul. And the religious life consists in emancipating oneself from all of the trammels of the senses until one is lifted in ecstasy and united with the divine. Now, I mentioned before this tendency to spiritualize religion and disparage the externals. That is the Neoplatonic approach, and you'll find it in this tract. I'll read you an excerpt. Do you think you'll move God by the blood of a bull or by incense?
The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit. You venerate the wood of the cross and have no regard for the mystery of the cross. You fast, refraining from that which does not defile, but you do not refrain from obscene conversation. You adorn a temple of stone, but of what use is this, if the temple of the heart is full of abominations? With the mouth you bless, with the heart you curse. You enclose your body in a cell, while your mind wanders over the earth. Creep not upon the earth, my brother, like an animal. Put on those wings which Plato says are caused to grow on the soul by the ardor of love. Rise above the body to the spirit, from the visible to the invisible, from the letter to the mystical meaning, from the sensible to the intelligible, from the involved to the simple. Rise as by rungs until you scale the ladder of Jacob. As you draw nigh to the Lord, he will draw nigh unto you. If with all your might you strive to rise above the cloud and the clamor of the senses, he will descend from light inaccessible, and that silence which passes understanding, in which not only the tumult of the senses is still, but the images of all intelligible things keep silence. It's the ecstasy, the vision of the mystic. Biblical language and the Neoplatonic concept of losing oneself in the ineffable. So in this tract you have the spiritualizing tendency of Erasmus. Now much of that was taken over by the Reformation when it came to rejection of the pilgrimages and the cult of the relics and the prayers of the saints and so on. But it's all here to begin with. Well, then he had an opportunity to go back to England, and from England to Italy, because the position of King Henry VII was an Italian. He had two boys, and he desired to have them educated in Bologna, and said that he would pay the expenses of Erasmus if he would serve as a tutor to the boys. So Erasmus starts out with those two boys for Bologna. But when they arrived in Italy, they heard that the city of Bologna was being besieged by an army led by the Pope. The Pope was Julius II, Giuliano Secondo, and Giuliano il Terribile, the terrible Julius. He was a titanic figure of the Renaissance, like the great princes, the Sforzi, and the Medici, and the Visconti. He was magnificent, a patron of arts and letters. It was he who tore down the old Basilica of St. Peter's and began the present St. Peter's. It was he who discovered Raphael and Bramante and Michelangelo. Michelangelo did for his tomb the Moses. But all this takes money. Now, the source of money for the papacy in the Middle Ages had been taxes on a strip of territory over which the popes ruled as civil political rulers. This territory began in Rome, ran over the Apennines, and came to Ravenna in northern Italy. It was called the Patrimony of St. Peter, the Patrimonium Sancti Petri, and this was the pope's particular preserve. But now the Italian cities were whittling away pieces of it. Bologna had a chunk, and Ferrara a chunk, and Venice was taking a chunk. So the Pope, as a military commander, in armor, at the head of his own troops, besieged Bologna. Word came that the city had fallen. Erasmus and the boys continued their journey till they came to Bologna. They arrived just in time to see the triumphal procession, led by the white palfreys, by the cardinals and the leaders of church and state, and the Pope carried aloft by his soldiers to the church, that he might give thanks to the Lord Jesus for this glorious victory.
Aebutus, said Erasmus, magno congemito, with a deep sigh. Pope Julius playing Julius Caesar. And he went out to the countryside and saw the papal tax collectors already taking the cows away from the peasants. And he did not forget. Well, when the year was up, and that was the length of time he had contracted to care for the boys, he managed to go for a time to Venice. We don't know where he got the money from, but always it came from some rich friends. They didn't have any Danforth or Guggenheim or Fulbright fellowships in those days. A man had to raise his own money. Erasmus said the way to do it is to rub your brow so red that the blush won't show and then blow your own horn. Well, somehow he managed to get enough money to keep going, and he went to Venice. Well, now, Venice was a great printing center. The printer there, Albus Minucius, had a household of 33, all talking Greek. They were refugees from Constantinople. It had fallen to the Turks in 1453. That was over 50 years back, but there were second-generation Greeks by that time. Many of them had come to the island of Crete and then into Italy. So here they were, collecting Greek manuscripts, translating them into Latin, or publishing them in Greek in the most beautiful script. Those Renaissance books are just marvelous, and they're lasting a great deal better than our books. In our library, we have a lot of books printed in the late 19th century in which the paper is simply disintegrating. We don't know how we're going to preserve them. The only damage done to those old Renaissance books is that the worms have made wormholes in them. I've always hoped I'd find one of those worms. I've been hunting for one for a long time. I've never been able to find a specimen, but the little holes are there. But I better not go off telling you about holes. I could give you quite a few yarns on that. But anyhow, they're magnificent books. And they were being printed there in Venice. And Erasmus worked there for a whole year. He was bringing out a new book of his own. When he got it done, it was so fast that when Aldous told him he'd give him 200 copies, he said, "I'm sorry, I can't accept them unless you'll give me another horse." One very interesting point is that while he was there, he roomed with a young man named Aleander. He was a brilliant young man, 23 years old. Of course, he knew Latin and Italian, but also Greek and Arabic and Syriac and Hebrew. He was a brilliant fellow. Erasmus was almost as much attracted to him as he had been to Thomas More. We'll meet him again, too. Well, after the year, Erasmus had a chance to go to Rome. And now he was received with high favor. They knew about the book he just published up there in Venice and a number of translations he had published. And this little dagger of the Christian soldier, and one of the cardinals begged him to settle down in Rome and use all of the great libraries. But waiting for him in Rome was a letter from his old friend Lord Mountjoy, saying, "Come back to England. The golden age has dawned. Our marvelous Prince Henry has become Henry VIII. You can't imagine all the enthusiasm there was for Henry VIII as a young man. He was a brilliant tennis player. He was a patron of arts and letters. He could write letters in Latin himself. He'd written a couple of Erasmus. He studied theology. Later on, he was able to refute Luther, or at least make the attempt, in Latin. All of the young humanist scholars, that is, those interested in the classical studies, were enthusiastic that this patron of letters had become the King of England. Come back to England. The king wants you. He's written to you in his own hand. Archbishop Warham will give you a living. Come back to England." Erasmus started out on horseback, of course. Certain advantages in that kind of travel gives you a chance to think. When he got to London, he stayed in the home of Thomas More. And there he put on paper a little fantasy that he had been conceiving while he was on the way. It was to become possibly his best known and most popular writing, though he threw it off just as a little diversion. The title is a pun, In Praise of More, Encomium Moriae. But now in Greek, Moria means folly, foolishness. So, the praise of folly. Well, that touched him off. He has folly, a dame in cap and bells, mount the rostrum to give an academic lecture. She begins by praising herself. She says, I am responsible for the continuance of the human race. If people considered how much trouble it is to have a baby, they'd never have one. And if they'd had one, they'd never have another. But they don't consider, and I folly carry them all. I keep the human race going. Then she shifts. She's constantly shifting her character. She becomes the absence of that brutal candor which vitiates human relations. If a man thinks that his ugly wife is a Penelope, will he not get along better with her than if he is disillusioned? A little humbug is the lubricant of life. Why be too brutally open about things? But then folly becomes downright foolishness. She is the foolishness of a nobleman who wouldn't think of being a butcher but doesn't mind carving up a stag on the chase. She is the folly of a merchant who will leave his wife and family and go to far parts of the earth in order to bring home a pearl or a red thread to weave into a slipper. She is the folly of a ruler who isn't content with the territory he has but is always trying to get some more. She is the folly of a friar who wears such a filthy cowl that no ship's captain would put it on in a storm, and thinks that if he wears that thing and comes up to heaven and appears before the Lord Jesus, he'll get a reward for it. The folly of a pope, who, if he remembered the meaning of pope, papa, father, would not be fighting to get the position. The folly of a scholar, who ruins his health and his eyes, poring over old manuscripts like that Erasmus. Well, where are we now? Does he really mean that scholarship is just as foolish as the behavior of the nobleman, of the merchant, of the ruler, of the friar, of the pope? Or is he handing out a song to those whose gorge is rising? Then folly changes again, and now she is the foolishness of God, who chooses the weak things of the world to confound the mighty. And then she becomes the folly of the cross, a stumbling block to the Jew, a laughing stock to the Gentile, but the power of God unto salvation. And then she is the folly of the seer, the mystic, who, wrapped from all the things of sense, is caught up in ecstasy until he is united with the ineffable. Now, what does it all mean? Some have said it is the likeness of the Renaissance. I doubt it. I think I found a clue to it in a sermon of Erasmus on vanity of vanities. And the vanities are all those that he has pilloried in the praise of folly, including scholarship. But then he says, shall we not then engage in family life? Shall we not engage in political life? Shall we not engage in scholarly studies? Yes, but involved as if not involved, having as if not having, immersed without being submerged, participating as if not participating, remembering that we are citizens of another city, pilgrims and strangers, traveling to a city whose builder and maker is God.
I would suggest that what we have here is an ironic version of the contempt of the world. He was criticized for it on the ground that it had a spirit of levity. And he said, I meant nothing by the phrase of folly that I had not meant by the dagger of the Christian soldier. And it's interesting that each of them ends with this experience of the rapture of the seer. Well, he was back in England. He settled down for 2 years at Cambridge working on Greek, and we hear a little of it. But in 1511, he had to go back to the continent because his patrons were not able to support him anymore. And the reason was that that glorious Prince Henry had gone to war on behalf of Pope Julius. The way it came about was this. Julius, after taking Bologna, attacked Ferrara, and after Ferrara, he attacked Venice. Then France came in to defend Venice. And then England crossed the channel to embarrass France. And by so doing, was on the Pope's side. The money of the noblemen was taken for the war, and many of them had to go over and take part in it on the continent. So Erasmus, now in dire poverty, went back to the Low Countries, and there barely managed to exist for some years. But in the year 1513, 2 years later, Pope Julius died. And then there came out a little anonymous tract entitled, Pope Julius Excluded from Heaven. The Pope is accompanied by a little, companion, and he is engaged in a dialogue with St. Peter. The Pope is in armor, and on his breastplate are the letters P.M. He gets out his key and puts it in the lock of the gate of heaven. What the devil? His companion says, maybe you got the wrong key. No, he said, it's the key of power. It used to work on earth. Peter hears the rattle. He looks over the gate. What a stench. Who are you? Can't you read? P.M. Pestis Maxima, big pest. Pontifex Maximus. And who are you to talk to me? I'm a Ligurian Italian. You're only a Jew. Well, why are you proud of your country? I want my country to have the credit of me. Well, what's so creditable about you? I captured Bologna. Oh, you did? Well now, Bentivogli, the ruler, was he a tyrant? Was he a heretic? No. What then? I wanted Bologna for my son. Popes with wives and sons? You don't understand. Sons, not wives. Well, tell me now. What have you done that I should let you in? I built up the papacy. You ought to see our processions. Horses prancing, boys dancing, dishes steaming, bugles blowing, and I carried her off by my on the shoulders of my soldiers. It's magnificent. We didn't have anything like that in my day. Well, the job wasn't worth having in your day. No, in my day, we had shipwrecks, scourgings, beatings, imprisonments, crucifixions, and we conquered by suffering. Well, then you wait till next year till more of my soldiers die and come up here and we'll knock your gates down. Did Erasmus write that? He did not say, I did not write it. But in effect, he said, how would anybody think I would do such a thing? Well, we know that Thomas More had a copy of it in Erasmus' own handwriting. Ha, 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 ha
And Thomas More undertook to defend him. He gave all the reasons why it wasn't likely that he would do it, and then said, but suppose he did? Well, he knew the facts. Would he ever have supposed that he did if he knew that he didn't? And then there's another poem. There's a poem which is even more stinging. It makes a comparison between Pope Julius and Julius Caesar to the disadvantage of the Pope, and says only one point is lacking to the comparison, and that is another Brutus. Well, did Erasmus write that? That was long in doubt until about 2 years ago. Inside of the cover of one of Erasmus' books, it turns up in his own handwriting. So when you put those two things together, it seems to me pretty well certain that he did it. But there's one puzzle. There's one early copy of this little tract with the initials F.A. Poet Laureate, Fausto Andrelini, that Italian to whom he wrote that gay letter. So some people think that this man wrote it. Well, I can't go into all the details, but I think perhaps they collaborated. They were together in 1511 in France for a while, and there's a lot in the tract I didn't give you about the dealings of the Pope with France, and that would be better known to Fausto than to Erasmus. But the whole style of it is certainly Erasmus. But anonymity is dangerous. The price that Erasmus paid for this was that for the rest of his life, every anonymous tract against the papacy was attributed to him. And it's quite obvious that most of them he'd had nothing to do with. Well, he was doing a whole lot more than writing satirical works. He was very strenuously working on an edition of St. Jerome. He brought out several tracts on political theory, the Institute of the Christian Prince, its moralistic politics. The ruler should not try to get more territory, but rule well what he's got. And Erasmus lays out a whole program of social welfare. Much of it is like Thomas More's Utopia, with which Erasmus collaborated. And then a tract called The Complaint of Peace. It's one of the classics of the peace literature. He shows peace going up and down the earth and lamenting that no one will receive her. That's strange. The Old Testament predicted a prince of peace, and Christ said, my peace I give unto you. Who's to blame for this? Not the common people, but kings. Not the laity, but the clergy. And they even cast cannons with the names of the apostles Peter and Paul, who go out to blast each other on the field of battle. Consider the wickedness of it. People who are locked up in time of peace can be used in time of war. Consider the expense. With the money that it takes to besiege a city till it surrenders, you can build another one. And consider the folly of it. Man is but the creature of a summer's day, and why is he so eager to hasten his extinction? What then? Let us forget these cries that an Englishman is the natural enemy of a Frenchman or a German or a Spaniard. For though the Pyrenees divide the Spanish and the French, and the Rhine, the Germans and the French, and the Channel, the English and the French, they cannot divide those who are united in the love of Christ. Let us then bind up discord with adamantine chains which never can be broken. It is a tract which has been translated and republished in every great European conflict. And he was also working on a translation and edition of the New Testament in the original Greek. This he brought out in Basel with the great printer Proben in the year 1516. It is the first appearance of the New Testament in the original language in print. Erasmus didn't have too many manuscripts, only five, and not earlier than the 11th century. He spent the rest of his life finding more and putting out new editions. There were five editions all together, and we have all of them in the Yale Library. The first edition of the New Testament
in the year 1516. It was a great pioneer work. The Praise of Folly isn't his greatest work, but his New Testament. Nobody looks at it anymore except an historical scholar, but it served as the point of departure for all of the better editions which came later. He not only published the text, but he called attention to the textual problems he left out. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory. It's simply not there in the manuscripts. It crept in later through the liturgy. The Catholics, of course, have never used it in the Lord's Prayer. The Protestants did. But it's not there. He left out, there are three in heaven that witness, the Father, the Spirit, and the Son. They said, you don't believe in the Trinity. Yes, I do believe in the Trinity, but I tell you, this text is not there. It wasn't in any manuscript that he had. Well, they made such a cry over that that he said, all right, if you can find it in any Greek manuscript, I'll put it in the next edition. They found one, as he suspected, manufactured for the purpose. But true to his word, he put it in the next edition. He justified so doing on this ground. He said, it is in the Latin translation of St. Jerome, made in the 4th century. Now, Jerome would never have made it up. It must have been in the Greek text that he was using. Now, it's not in St. Cyril in the East, and it's not in St. Bede in the West, but it is in this Latin translation of Jerome. So, there must have been discrepancies in the 4th century. And if so, how can I decide which is original? What he didn't know was that it doesn't get into the Latin of St. Jerome till the 8th century. You can't use a translation to check an original unless you've got the correct text of the translation. So not knowing that, he put it back. Well, the effect of it was that Luther, who used the edition of 1519 that didn't have it, did not put it into the German. But Tyndale and Coverdale and all the English used the edition of 1522 in which it had been put back. So it went through all the English translations down to the revised, to the RSV. It was in the King James. But it's now recognized that it's spurious. Leo XIII, the Pope, pronounced it genuine, but a committee of Catholic scholars more recently has decided that it's spurious. So now it's out of all of our English, all of our standard, our recent English translations. Then he put out a new translation directly from the Greek instead of the traditional Vulgate. And he, for example, the Vulgate said, and Jesus came saying, do penance, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. He translated it, be penitent, and then simply repent. And it cut the ground from under the Catholic text for penance. And there were a good many other changes. I haven't got time for them. But he put out in addition paraphrases of the Gospels, a sort of elaboration of the meaning of the biblical passages. His paraphrases on the four Gospels were translated into English, and it was decreed that they should be set up in every parish church in England under Edward VI. We have two copies in the Yale Library. I'll give you only one example of how he handles the material, the prodigal son. And when he came to himself, he said, I will arise, and I will go to my father, and I will say, Father, I have sinned before heaven and before thee, and am no longer worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thine hired servants. And he arose. And while he was yet a long way off, his father saw him. The one who had the greater love did first espy the other. And the old man ran. And the boy began his speech. But he got out only the first words of it. Father, I have sinned before him. And the father threw his arms about him and kissed him and called for the robe and the ring and the phanica. Now that father is God. Erasmus was now about 50. He had more friends in high places all over Europe than anybody else. Now kings vied with one another to have him come to their courts. He'd been made a counselor of the emperor. The Pope invited him to Rome. This was the peak of his reputation. And the next year, 1517, Luther came out with his theses. Erasmus sent a copy to Thomas More, and he said to a friend, "I don't see much that's wrong with it." He said he'd been a little too tart on purgatory, because Luther said the Pope has no jurisdiction over purgatory, and if he does, he should empty the place free of charge. Well, that may be a little, that's a little rough. But otherwise, he didn't say anything wrong with the 95 Theses. When they began clamoring that Luther was a heretic and should be sent to the stake, he said he's a good man. He should not be coerced, but convinced. And he wrote to Frederick the Wise and said, "You, as his prince, are responsible for seeing to it that he has a fair hearing." And that's what Frederick did, and Erasmus told him that that was his duty. Then when finally the Pope came out with a bull, "Arise, O Lord, a wild boar has invaded thy vineyard." It was a new Pope, it was Leo X. Erasmus said, "I don't believe the Pope wrote it." And when he finally found that he did, he said, well, he was very badly advised. Then during the next summer, Luther came out with his address to the German nobility, in which he proposed that the papacy be stripped of pomp and power and be reduced to apostolic poverty. Erasmus agreed. The only thing he didn't like about it was that Luther called the Pope Antichrist. "Oh man," he said, "they're not all Antichrist. Do be discriminating." Well, of course, Luther didn't say they all were. He said the institution was Antichrist. Then Luther came out with his tract on the sacraments, in which he denied transubstantiation, said that the body of Christ is really there because it's everywhere. And what is special about it is that his presence is here disclosed. Luther universalized the presence of Christ. Erasmus said, if the church says there's transubstantiation, all right, there's transubstantiation, but remember, no matter what happens to the bread and the wine, they won't do you any good unless you commune with Christ in your heart. Luther universalized, Erasmus spiritualized. But Erasmus said, the breach is irreparable. He thought the Catholic Church would never come to terms with that teaching of Luther. Well, finally, on December the 10th, Luther burned the Pope's bull. "Oh, now you didn't need to do that," said Erasmus. Then came the Diet of Worms, and the whole Erasmian party tried to work out a compromise and didn't succeed. Luther was put under the ban of the empire and declared to be a heretic. Erasmus said, "This is perfectly outrageous. Luther is not a heretic." Erasmus was back in the Netherlands. And this was the area in which the persecution of the Lutherans began, because it was the area in which the emperor was also the local prince and didn't have to ask any Frederick the Wise what he was going to do. So here the pressures began. And the man who came from the Pope to settle the thing by burning half a dozen Lutherans was Aleander, that old friend with whom Erasmus had roomed in Venice. They met. The interview was cool. Then another man came to see Erasmus. His name was Hutten, H-U-T-T-E-N. He was a poet and a German nationalist who wanted to make Germany into a national monarchy like England and France and Spain. The way to do it, he said, would be to have the emperor convert the Holy Roman Empire into a German national state. But it can never be done without driving out the prince bishops, because the bishops were princes. So there'll have to be a war on the papists. And Hutten came to Erasmus to get a letter of introduction to the emperor to persuade him to drive the papists out of Germany. Erasmus thought he was joking. People didn't always know when Erasmus was serious, was joking, and he didn't know when they were serious. But when he found that Houghton meant it, he was absolutely aghast. A war against the papists? The emperor to start a war against the pope? Later on, he did fight the pope, as a matter of fact, but not in order to make Germany into a national state. Erasmus would have nothing to do with it. He wouldn't have anything to do with Aleander, who wanted to burn the Lutherans, and he wouldn't have anything to do with Houghton, who wanted to drive the papists out of Germany. He's in the middle. When he went to church, he heard the priest who was preaching say, "If I could get my teeth into the gullet of Martin Luther, I wouldn't hesitate to go with bloody mouth to the altar and partake of the body of our God." That's too much. "I leave," said Erasmus. "I left the Netherlands," he said, "to avoid being turned into an inquisitor." And he went to Basel and stayed there for the next 7 years of his life. And then who turned up in Basel but who? He didn't get the emperor to start the war, but he did get a leader of mercenary troops to attack the Archbishop of Trier. They were beaten, the other man was killed, and Houghton, as a refugee, turned up in Basel. Well, Erasmus was back in Basel, having left the Netherlands. When he arrived in Basel, the Pope, a new Pope, a Dutchman, an old friend, invited him to Rome. He said, "If I go to Rome, the Lutherans won't read me." Then Houghton turns up and wants to see him. He wouldn't see him. If he talked with Houghton after what he'd done, he couldn't talk to the Catholics. So he won't go to Rome. He wants to keep the door open to the Lutherans. He won't talk to Houghton. He wants to keep the door open to the Catholics. Then Houghton came out with a tract. "I'm stupefied and shaken to know what's happened. That you who once joined with us to demote the Pope, you who inveighed against the cesspool of Roman crimes, you detested bulls of indulgence, and so on and so on, and now you turn around and butter the Pope. Hey, you say that Luther throws the apple of discord. Anyone who proclaims the gospel throws the apple of discord. Haven't you said that if Luther goes under, evangelical truth and liberty will suffer a great loss? How can you then oppose? Don't you see what it will mean? If right or wrong, you line up with a mighty. I would never have thought this of you. I would have sworn that you would stand to your post. I believed you would be unshakable for truth. I grieve over your defection." And it's largely Houghton's picture of Erasmus which determined the Lutheran picture until recently. Erasmus replied, "I don't deny that I seek peace wherever possible. I believe in listening to both sides with open ears. I love liberty. I will not, I cannot serve any faction. I have said that all of Luther's teaching cannot be suppressed without suppressing the gospel. But because I favored Luther at first, I don't see that I'm called upon to approve everything he said since. I've never called him a heretic. I have complained of dissension and tumult, and at the same time, I have always deplored tyranny and vice in the church. Let us not devour each other like fish. Why upset the whole world over paradoxes, some unintelligible, some debatable, some unprofitable? The world is full of rage, hate, and wars. What will the end of it be if we employ only bulls and the state? It's no great feat to burn a little man. It's a great achievement to persuade him." Well, now all the pressure was put on Erasmus to come out against Luther. Henry VIII writes him, Francis, Duke George, they all say, "Come out against Luther." The Pope writes him, "You've got to come out against Luther." "Oh," said Erasmus, "I don't want to deprive others of the honor of refuting Luther." He wrote to Zwingli and said, "Either I won't do it, or if I do what I say, they won't like." But the pressures got hotter and hotter. He realized that if he wanted to stay with the church, and he did, he'd have to indicate that he disagreed with Luther on something. But first he put out a tract on the immense mercy of God, who does not quench the smoking flax. Then a tract on what's essential in religion. And he says that most of the points about which we're persecuting don't need to be believed for salvation. It's penitent thief theology again. Then he had a dialogue between himself and a Lutheran in which he examines the Lutheran on the Apostles' Creed, finds he believes all of it. All right, said Erasmus, a man who believes all the Apostles' Creed is not a heretic. And Luther's not a heretic. But I do disagree with him on one point, and that is the freedom of the will. Now, I think they misunderstood each other. Erasmus thought that Luther thought that man was just a log or stone and couldn't do anything. Luther thought that Erasmus thought that man was good enough to earn his salvation. But neither of them thought that. They both agreed that man can do all of the ordinary acts of life. And they both agreed that man is so imperfect that he'll fall down somewhere and will never have any claim on God. And Erasmus agreed on justification by faith.